is Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Medicare fraud. With the Medicare open enrollment period closing December 7th, scams have been rampant. We speak with the executive director of the New York Statewide Senior Action Council about some of the most popular scams to be aware of and how you can protect yourself. Science stories with Joe Johnson. Joe is our resident science guy. He's got stories of wasps that can thrive on just alcohol without getting buzzed, and other science stories that caught his eye. Just in time for Thanksgiving, Cat's Cast visits the unique International Museum of Dinnerware Design in Kingston, and violinist Akiko Hosoi performs at the Sullivan County Chamber Orchestra recital. Classical Kit is here with a preview. That's coming up, but first the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Biden is spending his final day in South America at the G20 summit. He's working to further his climate goals before he leaves office. NPR's Asma Khalid reports from Rio de Janeiro.
Biden has spent his presidency trying to invest in clean energy jobs in the United States. His team says the climate discussion has fundamentally moved into the realm of economics. At the G20 summit, Biden is announcing a $325 million U.S. contribution to a climate investment fund to help developing countries with their clean energy transformation. Biden is also meeting with Brazil's president, Lula da Silva, to launch a clean energy technology partnership. It's not clear what, if any, of this President-elect Donald Trump will keep. He's vowed to roll back some of Biden's clean energy incentives. Asma Khalid, NPR News.
Russia has changed its nuclear posture. President Vladimir Putin approved guidelines that let Russia use nuclear weapons if hit by a massive air attack. This comes after President Biden allowed Ukraine to use U.S.-made long-range conventional missiles to attack Russian territory. Russia is claiming Ukraine has used these conventional missiles today in a strike. A Wyoming judge has struck down abortion bans in that state. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Merzbach reports abortion rights supporters are pleased with the decision.
Wyoming OBGYN Jovanina Anthony says she breathed a sigh of relief when she heard the news. She's been waiting to hear for almost a year whether the state's near-total abortion bans are constitutional. But she says the fight isn't over.
I'm super thrilled, but also cautiously viewing the future and what that may hold, especially with the next legislative session.
A representative for Wyoming Right to Life says the state will likely appeal the case to the Wyoming Supreme Court. For NPR News, I'm Hannah Merzbach in Jackson, Wyoming.
Stocks opened lower this morning, even as quarterly earnings indicate shoppers flocked to Walmart in search of bargains. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped about 350 points in early trading.
The nation's biggest retailer reported better-than-expected sales and profits for the most recent quarter. More customers visited Walmart stores, and they spent more once they got there. The discount chain says much of the increase was driven by higher-income shoppers. The Lowe's home improvement chain also reported better-than-expected results and raised its forecast for the rest of the year. Home building activity slowed last month, partly as a result of back-to-back hurricanes. Permits for future home construction were also down slightly. Still, a survey by the National Association of Home Builders shows growing confidence that market conditions will improve in the coming months, despite persistently high mortgage rates. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. European officials are investigating how two undersea communications cables were cut. Germany's defense minister is blaming sabotage that has not been proven. Officials say the cuts have not interrupted communications traffic. It will take a couple of weeks to repair damage. SpaceX will try again today to launch its giant Starship rocket on another test flight from its facility in southern Texas. News reports say it is possible President-elect Donald Trump may come to view the launch. NPR's Jeff Brumfield has more.
Starship is the largest rocket ever built. SpaceX CEO Elon Musk hopes it will someday carry people to Mars. But first, the rocket has to be put through its paces closer to Earth. SpaceX's testing has been slowed by environmental concerns. Earlier this year, the EPA found its launches were in violation of the Clean Water Act. But with the soon-to-be return of President Trump, who counts Musk as a close ally, regulations may no longer be an obstacle. Lori Garver is a former deputy administrator of NASA, and she predicts
the FAA and the EPA will not be raising flags as they have been these last couple years.
This next launch aims to see Starship fly partway around the world before landing in the southern Indian Ocean. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
World climate talks continue in Azerbaijan. Developing nations are pressing more wealthy countries to help them pay for the costs of dealing with climate change. This comes as scientists warn the planet is very close to warming to a point where climate change could turn even more destructive. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. With the Medicare open enrollment period closing on December 7th, scams have been rampant. Maria Alvarez is the executive director of the New York Statewide Senior Action Council, an organization dedicated to advocacy for the rights of seniors in New York State. And she joins us with more and what to look out for. Maria, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me on today.
Thanks for being here. And thanks for letting us know about these scams. What kinds of scams are happening to folks right now during this Medicare open enrollment period?
Well, there's a few different tactics that these scam artists are taking. Some of them include things such as enrolling people without realizing that they're without their permission into plans, without them knowing, pressuring enrollees with false time limits, saying, for example, you have to sign up now. If not, you're not going to be able to do this. And that's not true. Cherry picking. The plans are only enrolling healthy candidates. If they can get your information, that they strive to enroll healthy candidates. And dishonest brokers who enroll beneficiaries in plans without their knowledge. So, for example, by colluding with nursing homes or retirement community administrators. Of course, I want to point out this is not in every single case, but it is happening.
And will folks contact folks over the phone about Medicare? And does Medicare ever call people, really?
So that's one thing that we should definitely let the listeners know is that Medicare, Social Security, and the IRS will never contact patients or people. They'll never call them up. Usually what happens is people might need assistance from Medicare. So the best thing to do is for you to call the 1-800 Medicare number, and that way you know who is, that you're calling a legitimate source. But Medicare or their representatives will never contact anybody by telephone.
And what about other ways of communication? Are folks reaching out to folks in the open enrollment period during with text messages or email or the mail? Is there anything particular to these forms of communication that Medicare recipients or caregivers should look out for?
Yes. We always advise people never to click on links that might be texted or in your email. That's number one. Number two, I think in all of this, it's very important to keep a healthy level of suspicion, right? Because the thing is that many times they contact beneficiaries without the beneficiary's permission, and many people don't know that a plan, a company cannot reach out to you unless you've given them express permission to do so. So sometimes people get inundated with all of these different mailings and literature and information, and it gets very confusing, and sometimes people might sign up for things unaware that they're doing so. So our advice is always, number one, if somebody is reaching out to you, don't even assume that is the person who's calling you, because now with there are so many advancements with artificial intelligence, and they also have the ability to change the wording on the caller ID. So many times people might think that they are speaking with their doctor's offices or their health insurance plan, and it's not that person. So always the best thing to do is, if somebody calls you and you don't know who it is, or you've never had dealings with them, don't pick up the phone. And then what you do is you call the number that you know. So for example, if it's your healthcare plan, look at the back of your health card and call that number. If you want to talk to Medicare, call 1-800-MEDICARE. That way you're in control of who you're speaking to, because you are initiating the call. I would say that if somebody leaves you a telephone number to call, ignore that number, because that just might be the fraudster trying to give you his number. So then you're calling the person who's trying to defraud you. And the best thing to do is to call the number that you know.
And what should someone do if they've made a possible mistake and revealed sensitive information to a scammer?
Yes, and that is something that, first of all, don't feel bad. Yeah. That's the first thing that we always try to reassure people, because these people who are committing frauds, this is what they do for a living. So their whole intention is to defraud you, and they're experts. So number one, get over the fact that we might have inadvertently given some information out to the wrong person. Then number two, you can either call the 1-800-MEDICARE number and speak with somebody at Medicare, or call our helpline, which is 800-333-4374. We're contracted by the federal government to provide assistance to people in the state of New York who may have this problem, and we will help, assist them in that situation. And another thing that's very important is, if you're ever in a situation where they're trying to tell you not to tell other people, a lot of times people will say, don't tell anybody about this. That's when you definitely call a trusted source, somebody that you know. You could call us as well, since we're authorized to help, and let us know what's happening, because fraud is a very isolating tactic that people use to deplete people's assets.
And this fraud costs taxpayers billions of dollars a year nationally.
Yes. Right now, last year, this fraud, Medicare fraud specifically, cost the taxpayer $60 billion. That's billion with a B, last year. And that is very concerning, because it puts the Medicare trust fund in jeopardy, right? We want to make sure that Medicare is around to serve as many generations as possible in the future. Number two is that we want to make sure that people's medical identity is safe. So if somebody has taken your identity to charge things or to get services that are not your own, your medical identity is in jeopardy, and it could mean your own health as well, as you also try to get services from your doctor or hospital or pharmacy. And it might be conflicting information. And also, if they have charged a lot of different services, the day that you need the services, they may not be available, because Medicare has already paid for them.
Let's remind folks before we go about a few of these scams. We mentioned that there are no Medicare representatives, or our Medicare will never cold call you. If someone says you must join a Medicare prescription plan, also known as Part D, that's not true, right? It's voluntary?
That's voluntary. It definitely is advisable, because there is a penalty if you don't join it, you know, on time. However, what I meant before is that the annual enrollment period ends on December 6th. So if you're on today, let's say, with somebody from a plan who is telling you you have to make a decision today, you don't. You have until December 7th to make your decision. Even if you're on December 6th speaking with them and they tell you you need to make a decision right away, no. You have until December 7th to make your choice, and if they're trying to pressure you, use high pressure tactics, that is a form of fraud, because that information is not correct, and they're just pressuring you to make a decision to sign into their plan.
Right. You won't lose your benefits, and you have that entire open enrollment period to decide. Also, watch out for people asking for personal information, such as your Medicare number, Social Security number, or bank information. And also, if someone offers you gifts to enroll in their plan, that's illegal. So watch out for these scams. If you are experiencing Medicare fraud, to report it, or errors or abuse, you can call the New York State Medicare Fraud Helpline, 800-333-4374, or visit nyseniors.org. We've been speaking to Maria Alvarez, the executive director of the New York Statewide Senior Action Council. Maria, thank you so much for joining us with this important information.
Thank you so much.
All right, we'll take a break, and when we come back, Science Stories with Joe Johnson. This is Radio Chatskill.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, a conversation with Mexican actors Diego Luna and Gael García Bernal.
I know friendship. I know what that is. But what I have with Gael is something else. What we have is called more like the your chosen family.
That's this week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Hey there, I'm Cassie of Rare Pair Radio. It's a weekly showcase of primarily female artists, but also a wide range of avant-garde musicians. I will be playing the fruit of post-punk, experimental, and fringe music, only on WJFF Radio Catskill. Rare Pair Radio, Friday at 8 p.m.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. An alcohol-only diet would likely confuse most species, but new research indicates that hornets can survive seemingly without any negative effects on a diet consisting solely of an 80% ethanol sugar solution. Joe Johnson is our resident science guy, and he's here with the story of those wasps that can thrive on just alcohol without getting buzzed, and other science stories that caught his eye, including ice melting in Norway that has revealed an Iron Age medieval mountain pass littered with near perfectly preserved artifacts, and scientists finding a seismic role in the formation of large gold nuggets.
We have three stories this week. The first one is about glacial archaeology. This is a new area of archaeology which is made possible by the melting of glaciers and ice patches. Now, there's lots of sites around the world where ice is melting and revealing these artifacts. In North America, up in the Yukon territories, there's a lot of indigenous artifacts that are coming out of the ice. In Scandinavia, they're finding a lot of stuff from the Vikings. And in the Alps, remember Ötzi, the Iceman, mm-hmm. that they found back in, I think, 1991? He's a good example of this. Now, the area I want to talk about is in Norway. It's up in the mountains of Norway. It's in the Lendbreen Pass. Back in the 1970s and 80s, they started finding artifacts. They found a spear and some other artifacts that were eventually dated to 800 to 900 AD. All right. So eventually archaeologists got up there in 2011 and they started surveying the area. And the pictures of this area are, it's a pretty rough place. It's very rocky, snowy. It's a slope, just broken up rocks, what we call a scree slope of about 30 degrees, about the size of 35 football fields. And they were scouring the area looking for artifacts, and what they found was a bunch of horse manure in one place, which, yes.
What does that indicate?
Well, it indicated that there were a lot of people there at one point with their horses, so they started finding a lot of artifacts in this area. Now, in subsequent seasons, they have found dozens and dozens of artifacts that have started to melt out of the ice. A lot of them had been displaced by meltwater, so they're not always, the context is not always really clear. A broken ski, for instance, was found, 250 parts of it were found 250 meters apart. They have found hunting implements. Apparently, they were hunting reindeer in the area, arrows, skinning and butchering knives, scaring sticks, which were used to scare the reindeer into a trap. And, of course, lots of reindeer bones that show evidence of butchering. A lot of horse-related stuff. They found snowshoes that the horses used. I didn't know that was a thing.
I didn't either.
Yeah. But they found bridles and iron horseshoes from later years, pack items, and even the remains of horses. They have found clothing and textiles, woven fabrics. They found an entire leather shirt, a tunic. They found mittens. And the one mystery they have is there's lots of rags. And they don't know what the rags were used for.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Kind of amazing they lasted for so long.
It is. Well, they were frozen in the ice. And so they were preserved, just like putting something in the freezer. It preserves it. They found hiking sticks with runic inscriptions on them. And one says, Ivan's stick, basically, in runes. So they had their hiking sticks named. Now, the pass was apparently used for travel, hunting, and they had livestock that was driven through there to summer pastures. They found these cairns, these stacks of rock, and eventually by following them, which was the trail markers, basically, they found a lost Viking settlement that nobody knew was there. So it was kind of cool. Now, lots more is going to be coming out of the ice as it continues to melt. So it's a story we can follow.
This is an ongoing archaeological program in the glaciers.
Absolutely. And as more ice melts around the world, they're going to find more and more sites.
Scientists have found a seismic role in the formation of gold.
Yes, gold.
So how does this work?
Well, this is an article from the September 2nd journal Nature Geoscience. The article was about the research and experiments regarding the formation of gold nuggets. Now, gold is very non-reactive stuff, so it would be hard for natural processes to concentrate it. So the formation of these large gold veins in quartz has always been a real mystery. Now, lots of gold is panned in streams. It's very high density and, you know, weathers out of the surrounding rock. It's about five or six times denser than rock is, so you can pan it and it goes to the bottom of the pan when you swirl it around. But a lot of gold is mined in quartz veins in very mountainous areas on Earth. Out in the California, you know, that's one of the areas they're looking at. Now, it should be noted that these areas they're finding it in are very tectonically active, lots and lots of earthquakes. Now, some of the nuggets are really large, and there's the mystery. How do they grow so large, and why are they found in quartz? So quartz is really interesting stuff. Silicon dioxide, it's the same stuff that glass is made out of. You know, glass is made out of sand, which is broken up pieces of quartz. But it's the second most abundant mineral on Earth, but the first most abundant piezoelectric mineral. Now, I got to define that term.
Well, I was going to ask you, what does that mean?
Yeah, so a piezoelectric crystal is a crystal that when you stress it, when you vibrate it or you squeeze it, actually produces an electrical current.
Oh.
Okay? A grill lighter is a good example. When you squeeze the button, it goes pop. You're actually squeezing a little crystal in there, and when it releases, it actually creates a little spark, and that's what lights your gas grill. Okay, so scientists theorize that the earthquake vibrations would cause a slight piezoelectric current in these large quartz deposits, and that would cause dissolved gold that's in water, that's in groundwater, to be electrochemically deposited on the quartz, almost like plating, like silver plating or chrome plating something. And over millions of years, the gold would build up in these veins in the quartz. So they did an experiment. They took 12 slabs of pure quartz, and they put them in solutions containing 75 parts per million dissolved gold and gold nanoparticles, little teeny tiny particles of gold. Now, six were subjected to mechanical vibrations of 20 hertz, 20 cycles per second, and six were not vibrated. After an hour, there was measurable amount of gold deposited on the surface of the vibrated slabs.
And when you say measurable amount, is there an idea of how much this is? Are we talking a gold bar or is it much smaller?
Yeah, they are much smaller, much smaller. Measurable amounts, they're, you know, hundredths of a gram probably. But once again, over time, millions and millions of years, this is going to build up. And so this is going to tell us maybe where we can mine in new areas for gold. And what else could this process be used for? It's an interesting electrochemical.
And then scientists have been trying to understand this for a while now.
Yeah, they have. They have. Because like I said, gold is very non-reactive. That's why they use it for contacts in electronic devices, because it doesn't corrode. That's why if you have a gold coin brought up off from the bottom of the ocean, it's still nice and shiny because it doesn't corrode. It doesn't react with the seawater.
And finally, wasps that can hold their liquor.
Wasps that can hold their liquor. Yeah, absolutely.
What is this study about? They can thrive on just alcohol, but they don't get buzzed?
Very nice. Well, this is new research from the School of Zoology at Tel Aviv University. It was reported in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Now, alcohol, ethanol, ethyl alcohol, C2H5OH, however you want to talk about it, is commonly produced by the fermentation of sugars into alcohol by yeast. Yeast basically consume alcohol, sugar, and they excrete the alcohol as a waste product. Now, humans have been using alcohol for 8 to 10,000 years when we domesticated the grape. But we're not the only species that drinks alcohol, that consumes alcohol. Fruit flies can consume about 4% alcohol before they have negative effects. And there's an East Asian tree shrew that I had fun reading about. They eat alcohol-rich fermented fruits, but they develop fatty livers after a while. So they actually have it has an effect on them. Now, the wasp we're talking about is an oriental hornet, Vespa orientalis. And what they found is that it can consume huge amounts of concentrated alcohol with apparently no negative effects. Okay. Now, it's known that these hornets carry yeast in their digestive systems, and so they're constantly, I don't want to say drinking alcohol, but producing alcohol internally. So they did an experiment on a bunch of these hornets. In the first phase, they were given alcohol that was tagged with heavy carbon, carbon 13. Okay. And this would allow the researchers to actually follow the alcohol as the wasps metabolize it into carbon dioxide. They can measure the rate at which the alcohol is metabolized, and they were amazed at how fast the alcohol was broken down. You know, it might take you or I hours to process alcohol, but they can do it in an incredibly short time. Now, the second phase of the study, they gave these wasps up to 80%. That's 160 proof alcohol. And some were fed sugar water, and they saw no behavioral differences between them. They had the same mating behavior. They had the same, lifespan. They were able to process it so quickly that it had no negative effect on them.
So the problem with humans, of course, is given that amount of alcohol, there are going to be some interaction problems.
There's going to be a lot of problems.
So, wow, this is amazing. They are able to just keep going as normal.
Right, right. And the reason they think they looked at the genetics of it, and there's a gene called alcohol dehydrogenase gene that's responsible for the breakdown of alcohol, and they have multiple copies of it. And so they think that they just produce enzymes that just break the alcohol down so quickly. They can actually use it as metabolic fuel. They use it so efficiently.
Wow. You know how people talk about, like, if they come back in another life, they might want to be an animal or something? I might want to be that wasp.
You might want to be the wasp.
Joe Johnson, good to have you back.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Good to be back.
And we'll take a break. When we come back from that break, we'll go to the museum dedicated to dinnerware. Yep. We'll take a virtual visit next with Cat's Cast. This is Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill supporters include the Sterling Business and Technology Park, located at Exit 17 on Interstate 84 in Northeast Pennsylvania, offering opportunities to locate or expand businesses on property zoned for manufacturing and other uses. More information at sterlingbusinesspark.com. And listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
This is Jeff Loeffler. Join me each and every Friday, 10 to midnight, as we go deep, playing songs that you don't hear on the radio all the time. It's the Deep End.
Deep End.
Deep
End.
Deep cuts and live tracks from the worlds of classics, psych, prog, jam, and blues rock. The Deep End, each and every Friday night from 10 to midnight, right here on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, just in time for Thanksgiving, Cat's Cast, the Catskills podcast, visits the unique International Museum of Dinnerware Design in Kingston, New York. founded by Margaret Carney in 2012, the museum recently found a new home offering dedicated exhibits that celebrate the art and history of dining. Brett Berry hosts and produced CatsCast from Silver Hollow Audio in the heart of the Catskills, and he joins us now with more. Good morning.
Good morning, Tim. Great to speak with you again.
Well, you know, the Catskills always has something unique, and who knew there was an international museum of dinnerware design right here?
I didn't know until very recently, and when I found out about it, I gave them a call and set up a visit, and it's amazing.
Yeah, so we're going to take a little virtual visit. What are some of the inaugural exhibits?
There's one exhibit which is showcasing kind of the holy grails of dinnerware. So if you know anything about that world, which I don't know much, you're going to recognize a lot of those designers. And then another inaugural exhibit celebrates kind of dinnerware nostalgia in really interesting little scenes that are set up that showcase the dishes in environments where you might actually see them. So really, you know, interesting exhibit there. And then there's a little a la carte exhibit in the middle of the museum, which is going to change more regularly, I guess. And at the moment, it's giving visitors a chance to experiment with the tablecloth challenge, where if you've ever seen someone pull a tablecloth out and the dishes remain, well, you actually get to do this. And I did it. and it was a lot of fun. And there's a padded floor just in case it doesn't go so well.
Well, I'm excited for this because, fun fact, I like dinnerware in some of these designers like Ava Zeisel you mentioned, too. So I'm looking forward to hearing this. Let's take a listen to Brett Berry's latest edition of CatsCast, visiting the unique International Museum of Dinnerware Design in Kingston, New York.
Thanks, Tim.
It's Thanksgiving time again, and for many of us, that means pulling out the good dishes and setting a festive table. And if you're looking for inspiration, there's a new museum in town with a unique focus on dishes. It's one of a kind, in fact, and it just happens to be right here in Kingston, New York. Margaret Carney founded the museum more than a decade ago, but it's just now found its new home here in New York.
My name is Margaret Carney, and I'm director and curator of the International Museum of Dinnerware Design in Kingston, New York. We're on 524 Broadway. Now, I founded the museum in 2012 in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and the whole idea was that dining is something that brings various people together, people that don't know each other. They have shared dining memories and shared dining experiences. That was 2012, and here we are in Kingston in 2024.
Did that museum have a physical location? I understand from the site that it was kind of mobile.
Mobile is a good idea to describe what we were doing. We did not have a permanent location. We had office and storage, but we did not have an exhibition space. So we did pop-up exhibitions pretty much the whole 12 years.
So why Kingston?
Once we determined that we thought Ann Arbor wasn't the ideal place, we loved Ann Arbor, but it really wasn't a place for someone who wants their museum to be a destination attraction. We weren't going to be an old lady in an old house with some old stuff. And we wanted a lively space where people could have various dining experiences and that kind of thing. So of the names that were mentioned, including Minneapolis-St. Paul before the pandemic, and then we went to Palm Springs, California, because there's lots of people interested in dining there. And then someone mentioned to us when we were looking, because my husband's from Syracuse and we both were at Alfred at New York State College of Ceramics, we thought we loved New York. We got married in Lake Placid. We thought we should look at New York really carefully. So we looked at Corning, which was quite interesting, a logical place since they have the Corning Museum of Glass there. And then it was kind of a happenstance that someone said, well, you should look at Kingston. And I said, well, why should we look at Kingston? And they said, oh, they have so much money for economic development, and they also have all these old buildings that are cheap and available. And it turned out that that person, I think, was in a time warp maybe 10 years, 15 years ago, because we got to Kingston. We fell in love with Kingston. We met wonderful people. We looked at everything was interesting and ideal, but we didn't see any of the free buildings and money dropping from trees or anything like that. It turned out that that was 10 or 15 years ago when maybe Kingston was like that. But by that time, we'd already fallen in love with it. And we'd actually seen the space that we're located in today, which we are leasing, with the goal of having our own building 5 years from now. We'd like to have a capital before 5 years, we'd like to have a capital campaign and endowment fundraising drive so we can stay in Midtown Kingston, but either build our own building or procure a building that someone else has lovingly taken care of for decades or hundreds of years. We don't care because we need at least 20,000 square feet in order to do all the programming we want to do. And here with our storage in the building, we have about 6,000 square feet. We have 9,000 objects, which are in storage here in this space. So lots to share, and that's only 12 years of collecting.
The museum's two inaugural exhibits showcase just about 6% of the entire collection. Dining Grails features dinnerware masterpieces by designers like Eva Zeisel, Peter Sanger, and Shinichiro Ogata. Dining Memories occupies the other side of the museum, where dinnerware is featured in lifelike vignettes, like mid-century living rooms, outdoor picnics, and tea time on the deck of the Queen Mary. Here again is Museum Director Margaret Carney.
The two shows are called Dining Grails and Dining Memories. And of course, they both have the word dining in them. So I guess you're going to get the idea of what we're celebrating. Both shows together have probably about 500 objects in them that are related to dining, either functional dinnerware made by contemporary artists or by the leading designers for industry. And then we have what I'll call fine art. We have sculpture and drawings and things that are related to dining. They're either preparatory kinds of sketches for designs or they're actual finished works of art that are three-dimensional or semi-three-dimensional that are made in all different kinds of materials, because we wanted people to come in here, get the idea that we're not just about grandma's old dishes with little flowers on them, but we're interested in, say, Roy Lichtenstein here, which is a set from the 60s that was produced in a limited edition that we are lucky enough to have as a promised gift to the museum. He's a famous pop artist. We have wire scribble sculpture by David Oliveira, which shows that we have not just American work, but he's a Portuguese artist, contemporary artist. What looks kind of two-dimensional is actually three-dimensional, so he's drawing with wire to make it three-dimensional, three-dimensional objects.
I saw this piece on your website, this wire scribble, and I thought it was wire, and then I thought it was a drawing, and then I had to check that there were shadows in the photo, so I knew it was three-dimensional, but it really deceives the eye.
Light it so that you can see that there's shadows, because otherwise it does look like a drawing. He's remarkable. So in addition to wanting to just celebrate dining, we're celebrating the contemporary artists in the show, like Beth Lowe, Eddie Dominguez, who did the large-scale dinnerware over on the far wall. That dinnerware, if you look at it closely, it looks like a rose garden from here. But when you get up close, you can see that the leaves are actually dinner plates and that the bowls are the roses. And inside the bowls are the salt and peppers, which are form another part of the flower. So it's for 12 people that could walk around a buffet table, get their own plate and help themselves. We also have work from China here. There's a beautiful ewer that's white over on the far wall here. And that's from a buried city in China that was inundated by a flood of the Yellow River in 1108. It's a really beautiful form, but if you think about it, it was buried in that river silt for 800, 900 years and was discovered by farmers during a drought in China. So it's kind of like Pompeii, but instead of Mount Vesuvius, it's the Yellow River that had flooded it. But the interesting thing is all the objects were found in place on tables after their burial. So we have some exciting things here to share.
Can we go see that one up close?
Sure. And the reason that we know that this piece was buried is because you can see the rust-colored crackling and staining in the glaze, and that's from the iron that was in the silt that it was buried in from the Yellow River covering it for all those years. You could find a piece just like this, it looks like it, but without that, and that was made at the same kiln in China, but it wasn't from this same buried city. So you can kind of reconstruct what life was like in this buried city by some of these pieces, so it's interesting.
So I'm going to ask a real basic question for someone like you. What's the difference between ceramic, porcelain, china, stoneware? Is it all forms of ceramic?
Yes. That's a short answer. Basically, it's the same basic kinds of materials. I should ask my ceramic engineer husband here to explain all this better. But generally, for dinnerware, it's made either of earthenware, stoneware, or porcelain. And China is kind of a generic term for all of those things, but generally implies that it's a better quality thing.
Does the word China come from the fact that it was originated in China, or no connection?
That's what people say. So I believe it.
On the other side of the museum from the Dining Grails exhibit is their other inaugural exhibit, Dining Memories.
These are kind of my dining memories, or my imagination of them. And I envision that someday we will have other people coming in and curating their own dining memories, and they will be completely different. Maybe they're from a different country originally, or some different ethnicity, or something which would be a focus of their point. But in this case, we're looking at, I think, 11 different vignettes, which are supposed to be kind of abstractions of dining scenarios you'd see. So there's a mid-century modern dining scenario that has dinnerware that was created in Alfred, New York at Glidden Pottery between 1940 and 1958. And the dishes there are actually from around 1955, designed by Sergio Della Strologo. And they're shown on Haywood Wakefield period furniture. So that's kind of fun for all the people that love mid-century. And then there's a scenario that has kind of Art Deco, a refrigerator from the 40s, an Art Deco refrigerator where, you know, the blue color, people didn't have Tupperware and things like that. This is before plastic. And so they have ceramic containers that had leftover food in them, or water pitchers that you kept your water in and your kind of newfangled refrigerator, and some beautiful kind of streamlined Art Deco designs of the dishes that were done by Victor Schreckengoss. Some were produced for the various refrigerator manufacturers like Westinghouse, but manufactured by Hall China in East Liverpool, Ohio. And right in front of us is one of my favorites, being an old hippie, is the Peter Max dishes, the Love dishes, and ashtray and all that, and the mushroom stool, everything in the kind of colorful 70s, 60s, 70s orange and shag carpet with the Bob Dylan record and poster and the fake marijuana plant and a peace symbol and a hippie tie-dyed scarf. Anyway, so we're trying to recreate those sorts of dining memories, also with the brownie there that might have been laced with something in its original format. And then we go right over to another one of my favorites, and that is the a TV dinner scenario. It has the TV dinner, the aluminum tray with the leftover icky peas that were from the freezer, a TV guide of the era, the TV dinner box, which shows you it was a chicken dinner, is in the wastebasket nearby. So we've tried to recreate that memory. And for anybody that's of that era, they would remember that, like myself, that I couldn't wait till my parents went out to dinner because my sister and I got TV dinners. Don't tell this to my mother, but maybe she rest in peace, but her cooking wasn't as good as those TV dinners back then. It was much more fun.
A museum about dinnerware could be very stuffy. This museum is not stuffy at all. It's so much fun to see these sets and these little environments. It's really amazing.
Thank you. Well, our intention is to give people a different experience. We do have 9,000 objects, so I will tell you that the number of exhibits we have in mind and shows that will be guest curated by other people, not just by me, that will bring all kinds of things into full attention. So we might focus on one designer at some point and do an entire gallery with just that one designer's kinds of creations for many decades.
What can you say about how people use dinnerware these days, and how that maybe has changed over the years? Are people prone to bring out nice things, or is that reserved for holidays like Thanksgiving?
Well, I think it's kind of a mixed bag, because I hear, even today, talking to people that came in here, one woman was talking about how she lives in Kingston in a mid-century modern house, but the dishes that she got from her parents that she inherited, and her mom is still alive, that the dishes are kind of old-fashioned. And so this year they were going to get them out, not for the Thanksgiving dinner, but they were going to get them out for having like tea and dessert or something. So I think These dishes are full of memories, but not only that, they're full of your family history. So I think that people's dining things may be changing. Maybe there's not so much formal dining, but that's kind of come and gone too. So I don't know. I think people are dining more informally, but they still like to look at beautiful things. They like interesting things. They like to collect things. So I don't think, even though some people don't like inheriting china or it skips generations or whatever you want to say, I think that everybody's still going to be continue eating. People are conscious about throwing away paper plates and things like that. They're more conscious about that than ever before. So I think things are going to go, you know, full circle.
And for people who break out the fine china just for those fancy holiday dinners, do you encourage them to use it more often?
Sure. I don't believe that you need to tuck away things. I mean, who are you saving them for? You know, use them, enjoy life. This is what you got right now. And Eva Zeisel used to say that, like, the dishes she designed for Hall China, beautiful dishes from the 1950s, but she said basically that the sunset was for everyone to enjoy. It could have been the sunrise, but basically everybody should be surrounded by beautiful things. And as a designer, she wanted to design beautiful things and playful things to make everybody's life enriched. And I think that's what's true about how we all dine and how we're going to dine in the future. Is that people are going to appreciate that this is the moment, I'm going to enjoy it, whether it's a picnic or I'm going out to dinner or I'm eating at home or I'm getting a microwave dish. But it's the fun of that whole dining experience and sharing it with another person or a group of people.
Hours and directions to the museum are available at dinnerwaremuseum.org. Museum admission comes with a membership in the Turnover Club. Entitling the curious to turn over the plate at a restaurant or holiday dinner to see where it's made and by whom. Margaret assured me it's not impolite. This story was excerpted from today's episode of Cat's Cast, the Catskills podcast. And for WJFF Radio Catskill, this is Brett Barry wishing you a happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you, Brett, for that. And Cat's Cast, the Catskills podcast, can be found at catscast.com, K-A-A-T-S-C-A-S-T.com is how you spell it. And we want to, again, recognize Cat's Cast and Brett Barry for being voted best regional podcast for 3 years in a row. We'll take a break. And when we come back, we're moving toward health and we're moving toward Thanksgiving. Maggie Fitzpatrick has some tips for us right after this. This is Radio Catskill.
The Radio Catskill Music Auction is live, online. Bid on rare vinyl records, exclusive once-in-a-lifetime music performances, awesome electronics, and more. Don't miss your chance to get your hands on these incredible items and experiences. Place your bids now at WJFFradio.org. And don't forget the big annual music sale, November 30th at the Liberty Mall.
Radio Catskill's big annual music sale is almost here. Next Saturday, November 30th, 10 to 3 at the Liberty Mall in Liberty. Come get vinyl records, cassettes, CDs, the devices that play them, musical instruments, and more. And we're still accepting donations of records in good condition. And if you can't wait till next Saturday, we've got musical things that you can buy now. Radio Catskill's online music auction is live now at WJFFradio.org. And our big annual music sale is Saturday, November 30th in Liberty.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Every Tuesday, we check in with Maggie Fitzpatrick from the Sullivan County Democrat. She is their health and wellness columnist, and her column is Moving Toward Health. She joined us now. Hello.
Hello.
And a Thanksgiving tradition is our big music sale, as you heard. It's the Saturday after Thanksgiving. A big Thanksgiving tradition for most people is also overly stuffing themselves. So what advice do you have for us, health and wellness editor?
Oh, yes. First of all, I've never been to the music sale, so maybe I'll have to pop over there.
Saturday the 30th at 10 at the Liberty Mall. Come on over.
Yeah. But secondly, we have to get to Thanksgiving.
Well,
first.
We have to get through that first.
Right. So you are 100% right that usually Thanksgiving consists of overly stuffing ourselves, just like the turkey. You know, you got to stuff the turkey and then we stuff ourselves. However, what I have come to find for myself is that when I am overly stuffed on Thanksgiving, I tend not to feel very good. And, you know, can you relate to that?
A little bit.
Yeah. And when that happens and I'm in a place where I don't feel great, then I don't really want to be wherever I am. Right. And things that are really important to me on Thanksgiving are, of course, enjoying delicious food. That is a part of that holiday that I absolutely love. But the other part of it that's really important to me is being present and having lovely conversations with people that I care about. And when I don't feel good, I don't want to do that part.
So are there times where you put your health goals front and center on Thanksgiving? Are there times where you sort of pause?
Yeah. And this is where it gets very personal, right? And it's going to change for each person. It could change for you from year to year, right? I've had years where I have been mid some very serious goal, right? And that came front and center for me. And then I've had years where it wasn't that serious, right? And I was able to, you know, put whatever I was working on maybe on hold to enjoy some foods that I wouldn't normally consume, right? So for me, I don't eat a lot of like desserts or we were talking about simple carbohydrates recently, like breads, pastas, things like that, simply because they don't make me feel my best, right? I end up feeling very tired and getting crashes of energy after eating them. So I don't consume them that often, right? But on Thanksgiving, when you give me some Manchego mac and cheese, you can be 100% certain that I will be eating it.
Writing that down. Writing that down for the list.
Yeah.
Make Manchego mac and cheese.
Yes. I'll send you the recipe.
So thank you. So I guess what you're also saying is that the main difference between how much you enjoy Thanksgiving is not whether or not you prioritize your goals that you're currently in the midst of or planning, but how you make decisions, the decisions that you make.
Exactly. So we can get wrapped up here in, it's almost like an internal conflict, right? Of do I prioritize my health goals or do I just throw it all out the window for the day, right? And we can kind of swing back and forth between those two extremes. But actually, whether or not we're prioritizing our health goals isn't the thing that's going to make us feel our best. What's going to make us feel our best is actively choosing what it is that we want to do on that day and not letting the day kind of just steamroll us, right? Because I don't know if you've experienced this, but I've experienced it on Thanksgiving or other types of holidays or events where if I didn't go into it with a little bit of pre-planning, a little bit of intentions set, then I feel like the day kind of takes control of me and I am not the one that's in control of the choices that I'm making, right? So what makes me feel my best is not saying I'm not going to eat any foods that don't make me feel good, because like I said, I want to eat the pumpkin pie, okay? I want the pumpkin pie. But choosing to say I am also going to eat vegetables and protein because I know that those make me feel good, and I'm going to eat pumpkin pie and I'm not going to eat the whole entire pumpkin pie. I will maybe have a piece and then go back later if I want more. Making those intentional choices is what allows me to feel my best and then have the other side of the day feel really good too, which is enjoying the time with my family.
Some of this also gets tied up into the interpersonal relationships though too, because it's not just I want a piece of the pie. I might want a piece of Aunt Nancy's pie, or
yes.
I might not want a piece of Uncle Joe's potato cake or whatever it is, right? So
yeah.
you also have to kind of take that in consideration.
Yeah, I think especially Thanksgiving brings out the people-pleasing tendencies in all of us. and the reality is that you can go that route if you want, but you're probably not going to feel very good about it. And whether it comes to the food or the conversations that you're taking part in or who you're sitting next to, we get to have a choice in those things. We get to curate the day for ourselves, right? And if we don't actively curate our own day, the day will be curated for us by someone else who does not have the same priorities as us, right? And then we leave not feeling great. And so it really is up to us to take ownership of our experience on the day, whether like you said, it comes to the food or it comes to the conversations or anything else that comes along with it.
I find it kind of, it's hard to navigate because like I may like the stuffing, but I'm trying not to do too much of the carbs here, but I want to make sure, you know, Aunt Brenda is happy. So I'll take a little bit, I guess. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's probably like some of the stuff you have to do. You have to prioritize the foods on your plate, basically.
Yeah. You know, I think that it can be challenging because we don't want to upset people, right? I think most people don't want to upset someone, especially someone that they care about. But the more that we can be confident in our own decisions, the easier it is to say, like, thank you, but no thank you. And I love you at the same time, right? Like, this isn't a personal attack.
It's not about you.
This is me just prioritizing what's important to me right now. And that's really hard and it takes practice, but it's something we can move towards.
Yeah. And you talk about how you kind of curate the ideal day on Thanksgiving for yourself. Choosing yourself.
Exactly. And it comes with just a little bit of pre-thought, right? It doesn't have to be planned out to the minute. You don't have to have a schedule. Right. You don't have to have all of that. But just some thoughts on what's important to me. What do I want to experience today? And how can I maybe keep those things front of mind so that way it happens more than not?
What are you guys doing for Thanksgiving?
For Thanksgiving, we are going to my husband's parents' house, and it should be lovely. There is a very large Thanksgiving gathering for the Fitzpatrick family, probably about 40 or so people.
Whoa.
So, yeah. Talk about navigating conversations.
And navigating food. Do you have an expectation of like what foods will be there on the table? Because this is sort of a yearly tradition where you're going to get X, Y, or Z.
Yeah, I would say for the most part, we do have the same dishes. I was just talking about that with Kit, actually, but that's one of the nice things about Thanksgiving. You kind of know what to expect, right?
A little bit,
and
yeah.
So my husband and I, we always bring the same two dishes and we'll probably do that again.
Can you share with us, is one of them manchego mac and cheese?
One of them is manchego mac and cheese, which has white pepper in it, which we learned if you make the day before tastes a lot better, by the way. And the other one is a broccoli salad with raisins and walnuts.
There's a balance.
Yeah. And then I already mentioned the pumpkin pie. I have a dairy allergy. So that's why we bring that specific mac and cheese and that specific veggie. And then I will make a dairy-free pumpkin pie.
There you go. You're moving toward health. You're choosing yourself. Maggie
exactly.
Fitzpatrick is the health and wellness columnist for the Sullivan County Democrat. She joins us Tuesdays to talk about her column, Moving Toward Health. It's on newsstands now, or you can read it online, scdemocratonline.com. You mentioned you hadn't been to the music sale, so hopefully you can make it on the 30th at the Liberty Mall. We also have our Radio Catskill Music Auction live online now, so if you can't make it or you're really into music, you could go there now and bid on some items.
That's really exciting.
Are you a Wilco fan?
Not really.
No. All right. If you were a Wilco fan, work with me here. We have VIP concert tickets to Wilco in London at the Royal Albert Hall. Can you believe that? Also, are you a Paul McCartney fan?
Of course.
We have a Paul McCartney, the lyrics, sealed bound set of that book, the lyrics. There's also a Beatles bundle featuring a very rare t-shirt. Also, Gillian Welch and David Rawlings tickets, December 5th. In Port Chester, New York, tickets to that you can bid on. Bethel Woods concert tickets and a glamping experience. What about this? Are you a Van Halen fan?
Yes, of
course.
Okay,
we got the Van Halen Looney Tunes LP, which is like very rare, they say.
Wow.
Check it out. You can bid online, wjffradio.org, to get all of your music memorabilia and music fascination taken care of there. And then also don't forget the big music sale in person at the Liberty Mall on November 30th. Maggie Fitzpatrick, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. We are going to have Kit's interview with the Sullivan County Chamber Orchestra tomorrow on Radio Chatskill. So stay tuned for that. Come back. And in the meantime, have a great day. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Chatskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Thursdays at 9, it's Connect the Dots with me, David Christian. It's the freeform show where each song leads to the next by way of a musical connection. Think of it as a dive into music's liner notes, exploring the behind-the-scenes connections that show that the distance between genres and decades is often shorter than we think. That's Connect the Dots, Thursday nights at 9, here on WJFF Radio Catskill. Listen local.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, it's going to be cloudy throughout the afternoon, a high 55, mostly cloudy tonight, a low of 40. The Hudson Valley and Catskills and a lot of the state under a drought warning. We might get some rain late tomorrow night through Thursday evening, when it could possibly change to snow and accumulate 1 to 3 inches before ending late Friday night. So, okay, good for the drought. Tomorrow, some sun, turning cloudy, high 51. That rain later in the evening, cooler periods of rain on Thursday.
Support comes from Jeff Bank, Sullivan County's community bank, celebrating 110 years of service this year. Offering deposit and loan products for all your banking needs. Member FDIC and an equal housing lender. National Mortgage Licensing System and Registry Identification Number 405318. Jeff Bank. Still banking strong. And support comes from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.